Shaw Old Boys Union Oral History, Tuesday the 24th of July 2007. Jenny Hudson talking with Margaret Orchard at 5 Virginia Place, Forestville, New South Wales. Mrs. Orchard first came to Shaw from 1973 to 1975 to teach music and play the organ for chapel services. She returned in 1983 after raising her family and developed a music program in the prep school. She retired at the end of 2006, becoming the longest serving female staff member at Shaw, 26 years. She had served under three headmasters, Travers, Grant, and Dr. Wright. Margaret, can you tell me where you were born, when you were born, and something about your childhood and schooling?
Yes, I'd love to do that. I was born in Sydney in 1948. I was a baby boomer, as in that era, of course. And my parents moved up to the Northern Rivers, and my father's in CSR. So I had a country upbringing. And my father moved around in CSR a lot, and so we were in the country in the Northern Rivers. And we lived at a place called Howard Island and at Broadwater. When we were at Broadwater, I went to primary school in a little one-teacher school with the local children, who were also Aboriginal children. And at Woodburn, which was about 20 miles away, there was a convent. And we were given a piano from my mother's aunt, and Mum realised that I probably was interested in music and I was playing it all the time. So I then went to the convent and learnt piano, and every Saturday I was taken for piano lessons.
Did you actually attend school at the convent, or only music?
Only music on Saturday, that was all, yes.
And was there a music tradition in your family?
Not particularly. My mother's aunt was a musician, but both my parents claim they're tone deaf, so no, not in particular. So I was very fortunate as a child to have that type of teaching, because there were only two of us that went to the convent for lessons, and we were the only children that played the piano in that little town. So that was interesting. And I can remember going to a performance of the Australian Ballet, came to Ballina, and my mother took me, and I was entranced with all of that, because we didn't have opportunities in the country to go to concerts or anything like that. And so it was rather in isolation that I learned. And because my parents were moving around in CSR, they were concerned for my education for high school. And I would have had to go to Grafton High School after we'd moved to Howard Island. And so they decided that I should go to Neggs in Armidale, which was their family area, and both my grandparents were in that area, and that I would do 5 years of boarding school there, and then if my father moved, I wouldn't have to move school. And my father did move in my last year at school, and he was posted to Sydney. So I was very fortunate to go to Neggs and have my education in one go. And of course there was piano teaching there. That was the music teaching, that was all. I remember one girl came and she was a violinist, and I'd never really seen or known about a violin. And I found that wonderful. And of course we had the organ in the chapel.
And is that where your interest in the organ stemmed from?
Indeed. And so my piano teacher at that stage she used to play the organ, but she was a pianist and she'd never been taught the organ. And then when I was in, I think it was the year before my leaving certificate, a girl came from Newcastle and she had studied at the cathedral and she was a proper organist. And so I pleaded with my parents to let me learn. And so I did my seventh grade piano and sixth grade organ when I did the leaving. And she probably saved me is the word, because it meant that I was able to think about doing piano and going to the conservatorium in Sydney, which I was able to because my parents had moved to Sydney at that stage. So I came from Neggs, having not ever caught a train, never caught a bus, and didn't know anyone in Sydney. Mm. And so that was, I got a teacher's college scholarship to go to the Conservatorium of Music and Alexander Macke College. And so that's how it all started.
And what was the attraction of the organ for you?
Oh, I think for me it offered a very great scope, more scope than piano, because of all of the wonderful sounds, of course, as a child. I was quite passionate about it, and I found that I was drawn to it. And music in general, it was either me doing sport or music. We had a lot of sport at Meigs, and I loved all that, and I was the sports prefect. And so I had two things that I probably could have done, although my father said I should really get a steady job in the bank or in a pharmacy or something like that.
They didn't suggest business college and nursing to you at that stage?
No, not at that stage. No, definitely not. But no. They were, of course, parents who'd been through the war, who'd given up everything that they had ever wanted, and therefore they wanted their children to have everything. And so because I got a scholarship, my father allowed me to go. I think he felt that they could probably manage to afford it, because it was very expensive, as you can appreciate. And in those days, of course, a scholarship meant that you had a bond, a teaching bond. So there was a five-year teaching bond attached to that, which a bit like HECS now, I suppose. Mm. And so that's what I did. It was wonderful, wonderful time.
And what was the conservatorium like in those days?
Oh, well, I thought it was a palace. I thought it was wonderful. I was very excited to be there. Old corridors, we were always frightened of our teachers. We revered our teachers, I think that's what it was. And I found that I was at a big disadvantage compared to my friends that I met, because they had been in Sydney. They had been at schools where music was a very big subject, like maths or English or whatever. I only ever did it as an extra subject. I used to just do my practice before, you know, hop up at 6 o'clock, race down to the practice rooms, do my practice, and then I'd do sport all afternoon. Whereas these girls, of course, had done music for their leaving, and they had had orchestral experience, they had done history, harmony, and were able to study music as a subject, which I had never been privy to. So I found that it was like a Pandora's box for me. It was like Aladdin's cave. It was wonderful. And I had to work very hard to catch up, really catch up in many areas, singing, everything, history, harmony.
Had you belonged to a choir when you were a child?
Oh, at school, yes. But we were all girls at an all-boarding school. There were no day girls. Mm. And so it was very insular. And it depended on the staff they had there. And so, I mean, I didn't even do recorder. I didn't, you know. Other instruments were not catered for, because the music staff employed there were pianists.
And did you have to take another instrument at the conservatorium?
Yes, we all did, because we were going to be doing teaching. So I did piano, and singing was my second subject. And I did my organ outside. Nobody knew I did it. So I did it without it being part of my course, which of course now you can do a double degree at the conservatorium. And that was hard because I wanted to play organ. I wanted to be doing organ. I didn't tell my piano teacher that I was an organist as well. And I learned from Norma Johnson outside the course.
And did that complement your piano work?
Yes, from a sight reading point of view, it's a totally different technique. My parents lived at Beecroft when we came to Sydney, and I played the organ at St John's Beecroft. That was my first posting, and for a short time. And then I ended up at St Dunstan's Denison East, which was a little parish church. And then I went to Mark Starling Point as an assistant organist. And during this time I was studying with Norman Johnson at Skeggs Darlinghurst, now their chapel, which was St Peter's at Darlinghurst. I loved organ most. So that was a bit hard because I really wasn't studying that. It was the extracurricular, if you like. And then Eric Smith was at St Mark's Starling Point, and he was a theatre organist. And he went into the, is it the Wesley Mission in the city, into the big church there. And so I then became organist at St Mark's Starling Point. And later, at the same time I was appointed to Shaw, I was at St Stephen's Macquarie Street. So that's how the organ sort of progressed. And after I graduated from the Con, I was appointed to Epping Boys High School. And that was very confrontational. I was 20. I was very young because I did my leaving when I was 16. And I thought that Richard Dill was at Epping Boys High School, and he had been appointed at Epping Boys High School, but little did I know that he had decided to stay at Marsden High School, and I was appointed in his place, which I was absolutely aghast at. And I had a particularly wonderful headmaster called Jack Williams, and he supported me greatly because it was very hard as a young girl. Teaching music in this all-boys school. There were not a lot of women on staff.
Now, during your teacher training, what component of teaching was there for music students like yourself?
The course we did was in conjunction with Alexander Mackie College. So we were not full-time. In those days, you couldn't do a degree at the conservatorium. It was always a diploma in your performance. So our course was called a compromise. It was the second cousin to the correct course, if you like. And the musicians who did just performance looked down upon us because we were only doing half the time at the Con and half the time at Alexander Mackie. So we were always on the buses commuting between. And Alexander Mackie now is the art college, fine art college out at Paddington. And so we were taught, what were we taught? We were taught recorder so that we could teach at school. We were taught many other subjects. We had to choose a second teaching subject, like English or social studies. I chose social studies and I never taught it in school, of course. We used to do music. Music repertoire, I suppose, for schools, but it had little relation to the reality of teaching. We changed from the leaving certificate to the Wyndham system, and we were, of course, went into year 10 and year 12. So I graduated And my first year teaching, I had HSC students. I'd never seen an HSC paper. I'd never seen HSC curriculum. And I had to learn it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was elective music. It was a saviour in many ways, because those were the musicians that you had to work with. But I found it very difficult. I think I went through in the second year of this course, so they were still feeling their way, I think, with what would be useful. We did prac teaching, which was terrific, because we did it in infants, and then we did it in primary, and then we did it in high school. But I really, when I think back, they were very hard times, because we were not prepared, probably as well as we might have been, and the staff that had us were wonderful. You know, when you do prac teaching, you learn more probably by being there than being prepared and knowing exactly what it is.
They're quite long periods of prac teaching, aren't they?
In those days, probably 2 weeks.
Only 2 weeks? Six or so?
No. No, at the end of a year, and so just a couple of weeks.
That's not long.
It wasn't long. It was, I would call it initiation by fire, basically. Being appointed at a school was initiation by fire.
And what was the attitude to music teaching at Epping?
Very poor, at the bottom of the heap, and anyone who was musical was ostracised, I would say, probably.
Their peers?
Yes, yes. And that's, in those days, I think it was very hard. A girl who was appointed several years after I left, she went to the sportsmaster and said that she'd like the first 15 in the choir. And she did.
And she got them?
Yes. And so Epping, at that stage, then flew musically because they had the positive. I had some quite extraordinary students when I first went, and some of the names you will know. I had Graham Pushy, who's now world-famous countertenor, and Ivor Davies, who composed for the Bicentennial. He's known by the students from Ice House Rock Band. He went through as a classical oboe player and ended up in the Sydney Symphony Orchestra. And so he's quite extraordinary to have students like those, students who have carried on and who've also remained in touch. And so I was very fortunate that I had a very small group of boys that we just carried on. And because I was so young, I suppose, it was nice, because I didn't associate myself with the staff. I associated myself with the musicians, and there were some musicians on staff as well. So it was a very tough time, very tough.
How long were you there?
I was there for 4 years. And in that time, we would do a musical every year, and I think I did Half a Sixpence the second last year I was there, and Graham Pushy was the lead baritone, and then he came back for West Side Story, which was the next musical I did the year before I left, and he came back and played the lead in that, which is ironical when you think he's now a countertenor. But of course, this boy, when I first met him, was singing countertenor, and I'd never heard it. He sounded like me, because at that stage I was a mezzo. And so he actually sang for me at St Mark's Starling Point as a countertenor. He sang at school either as a baritone or as a countertenor, whatever we needed in choir or whatever. And later on, he studied with David Parker, and he was singing with David as a baritone and singing for me at St Mark's Starling Point as the countertenor. And I just
and he could switch.
Oh, yes. Well, all men can, actually. But, yes, and I said to him, you actually, Graham, you really must tell David that you've got a countertenor. And he did, and he never sang baritone after that. And so he went on to get a Churchill Fellowship from Australia to study overseas, and that was wonderful. That's been one of the joys of teaching music is the students you meet and who carry on with their music, and they've crossed your path, and it's just wonderful. You know, you learn so much from them. Quite extraordinary.
Very inspiring to have that quality of student in your first posting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's just quite extraordinary. Absolutely wonderful.
Mm. And luck, really.
Oh, yes. I mean, very much so. And it's the luck of who you meet on the way. Mm. And I was very, very lucky because the rest of the music was padding in the timetable, you know, general music, non-examinable, a good time to muck up. I think my first lesson at Ebbing Boys High School, I think three classes arrived to see the new music teacher, and the class that was supposed to be coming came in through the door, and the other two classes came in through the windows. So that was what I was up against, and that was, yes, it was tough times.
Did you find that putting on the musicals was a way of disseminating music appreciation through the school with an element of theatrical discipline thrown in?
Possibly. I was so absorbed with the music that I probably wouldn't have been aware of all of those things. Before school, after school, lunchtime was all rehearsals with boys and things. So I wouldn't have even known what the rest of the staff even thought, or what the rest of the boys even thought. I inherited a brass band. I didn't even know what a cornet was, let alone a tenor horn. And the boys basically taught me all that. And we went into an Stedford, and Cliff Bingham, who was the tuba player from the Sydney Symphony Orchestra, he was the adjudicator, and we played Dvorak's New World Symphony. And we came out with these trophies, and we walked into school, and that was a turnaround. That was interesting. The school got a bit of a shock when that happened. And then the choir went in a little Stedford or something, and we won a first place because I had voices like Graham and, you know, had some very good players. And I also had extremely good clarinetist in the band, which was brass mainly. And yes, that person was on staff with me at Shaw later. And I'll talk more about that later. Yeah. And so when we came in with some more trophies, that was nice, because it just gave the boys a standing, and it meant that there was a little more acceptance, I suppose. And I had a boy in the brass band whose father was in the St George Leagues Club band, and that was very highly regarded at that time. And we actually had the Leagues Club band play, all of them, for West Side Story.
Mm.
And that was absolutely extraordinary, because they were such fabulous musicians. And you don't normally put West Side Story on when you're a classical musician. I'd never done jazz. And so for me to conduct it or even learn it was very difficult for me. Mm. And at that stage I'd met Martin, and so we were engaged, and every time we went out I had my headphones on and I was trying to learn to conduct this piece of music. I was very lucky, because it was a big learning curve for me. And we'd never done musicals or anything like that in our teaching training, and of course that's what we had to do.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd done a bit of singing, but it was all classical singing and scales and arpeggios and, you know, all of those sort of things, which you don't go and sing in a classroom like an opera singer.
Mm.
So while it was good to be able to get up and sing in front of people, because that's what you had to do every day in a classroom, yes. They're extraordinary times, I have to say.
Certainly sounded. So, by 1973, what made you apply? Did you apply for a job at Shaw, or were you invited?
Well, when I married Martin in 1972, And just before that, I had done some auditions for Addington Palace, the Royal School of Church Music in London. And I sent over my tapes and I was accepted to go and study there. And so I was all set to go. And I met Martin and he said, well, you're not going, you're marrying me and we're staying. So that was wonderful. And so I actually had resigned from Epping and I then had to turn around and go, oh, well, now I've got to get a job back. I hadn't left Epping at that stage. And so, had I left? No, I hadn't left. And I think the department appointed me to Mossman High School, and we lived in Mossman. And several weeks before I got the appointment, we'd been to local voting at Mossman High. And I said to Martin, I think I'll ring up. So I rang up and I said, I'm just ringing, I've been appointed to your school and I just wondered how many music teachers you'd had this year. And they said, four. And I said, oh,
four in a year.
And I said to Martin, I'm not going. I'm not going. So I had to find a job and there was a job in the paper for sure. And they said they needed a teacher and an organist. And I thought, well, so I applied and had an interview with Jaika. And of course, prior to my appointment, they had always had very good organists who were organists as a profession and who went on to other cathedrals or whatever. And Shaw was well known, they had some outstanding musicians as previous organists.
As a stepping stone, more or less, in their careers.
Some, yes. Of course, Michael Dugman would be one case. And I studied with him. Actually, I'd actually been to Shaw before I was appointed because after I studied with Norman Johnson, he said to me at the end of 1 year, I'd like to go and study with Michael Dugman. And I said, no, I'm not doing that. I've never heard of him. And he said, well, you are. I'm not teaching you anymore. And so along I went to Shaw and learnt from Michael. So as while I was still at the conservatorium, I learnt from Michael. So that was very fortuitous. He was absolutely brilliant, absolutely wonderful. And I also went to Newcastle Cathedral and studied with him when he did go up to the cathedral for a little while. So the job at Shaw was because I had organ. And I guess, well, all of the organists took music classes, but my understanding was that elective music was not part of the curriculum at Shaw before I went, not as per se. So that music was taught in the classroom, and
at what level in the classroom?
Up to year 10. Up to year 10. Yeah.
And what sort of music?
Whatever the teacher felt like playing, I guess. I don't know what other people did. I think in those days the chapel and chapel music took up a lot of the music time because chapel, when I was appointed, I think was twice a week for every form. However, I can't remember the exact detail, but I certainly played a lot more then than I did later on when the curriculums were changed to accommodate all of the various subjects, requirements and so on that were required. And so I think that a lot of the music revolved around the chapel, and so there was the chapel choir. I think Bill Pierce did a lot of in his 7, 8 and 9 classes, he would have been able to do a lot of choir work with the boys, even if they mightn't have been in the choir. And the senior boys, the senior choir, would have done chapel music and not secular music. Putting on a concert in the hall with a choir, I think they probably would have sung sacred music, classical sacred music, rather than what we would consider just ordinary secular music. But, of course, music was also provided outside the curriculum with all the GMS in those days.
Of course, you see, that was a strong tradition.
Very, very strong. And all sorts of other people did, you know, the drama part. And the music teacher, I guess, I don't know whether how they did the music. In those days, I don't know. But so when I came, I had teaching as well as organ. And there are some stories when three boys came from Balgala, two of whom wanted to do elective music. And so I was called in by JICA and met the parents, and with a great sweep of the hand, JICA said, "Well, yes, of course we can do elective music. We have elective music, don't we, Mrs. Orchard?" And yes, headmaster, blinking, because of course we didn't have elective music. When these boys came, elective music was out of school hours for a term, and then I think it eventually got put in by JICA, got it into the timetable. I was very fortunate to get some students who were elective music students, and elective music did eventually get into the timetable.
Not through a school initiative, through pupil pressure, you might say.
Well, pupil request, pupil need.
Mm.
So, but these boys came in year 10, you see. They'd done year 10, so they came late. Yeah. They didn't come from year 7, so they came across.
But JICA was adaptive in that way, was he?
Well, I found him to be wonderful. He enabled me at Shaw, and I think I was maybe younger than his daughters, but he was extremely kind to me, extremely supportive, and I really only survived because of him.
Hmm.
There's no two ways about that.
So that was 1973 to 1975, your first period at Shaw.
That's right.
Now, Georgina Hart had been appointed librarian in 1971. Were you the only two female teachers on the... within the whole school?
Yes. And the school at that stage, you say the whole school. In the prep school, I'm not sure, but I don't think there were any women. But Georgina and I were the only ones in the senior school, yes.
And how did you find that?
I found that extremely confronting. Georgina and I looked after each other. We had many crying sessions in the ladies, many. And we had an immediate bond because of Negs, because we just shared, that history. And we immediately became like sisters. It was extraordinary. And she was really fabulous to me, because it was very, very hard for both of us, I guess. The common room was not our room.
Were you in that
the men common room meant men's room, and to have women in the common room, I think, was very confronting for many of the men staff. The staff who were our age, probably not so much, but tradition was extremely strong. And I mean, when we were there, the staff were called sir. They didn't know what to call us. we were often called sir or mum, I think. the boys were addressed by their surnames, never by their first names. And it was very much on the English public system, of which I knew nothing about. So to walk in the front gates, I probably felt as though I was walking into a book 50 years ago. Mm. You'd go into this other, it was an other world, and it was not what a reflection of society, I felt at the time. You know, that you, it was just different. You weren't treated, or you didn't behave in the way I suppose you would normally now. There's quite a flow that you don't feel this difference. The boys were the regimentation and the discipline, enforced discipline. All of those things, of course, having been to an all-girls school, you could imagine, you know, it was... Mm. Shocking. We were shocked, I suppose, and that having to survive in that area where I was, it took me a long time to be comfortable there, and I don't think I ever was comfortable for the first 3 years, really comfortable to not be on my guard all the time.
In how you behaved and what you had to say to other people?
I think just not being able to call the boys by their first name. That sort of thing I found quite difficult to handle, I think. And being very young, it was difficult. I wouldn't have been appointed if I wasn't married. That I do know. And it's not that you weren't respected at all. It was just that it was... the tradition was so strong that it was, we had to change to them.
Mm.
And probably I felt that the boys were there for the school. Now I think the school's there for the boys.
Mm.
So
coming from a high school, Epping High School, was the atmosphere within Shaw really extraordinarily different for the time?
Oh, yes. Because it's centred on the church, of course. And so they called scripture lessons at Epping, and many denominations were catered for, and people came, I think, from outside for that. Whereas Shaw, of course, is centred around the chapel. And so, yes, a totally different thing. And, of course, the uniform, Epping's a new school, and Shaw was an established traditional school. Totally, totally different. Yes, in almost everything, I think. Yes.
I remember Georgina saying that she was always feeling that hers was a service to the school and not really a part of the mainstream teaching effort. Did you feel like that too?
I would have felt probably... it's a very interesting comment, isn't it? My service to the school would have been playing for the hymns, playing for chapel, and Jaiki used to make me take hymn practice, stand up in front of the whole chapel, can you imagine? Year 10, 11, 11 and 12 boys, and would I practice the hymns because they weren't good enough? Mm-hmm. All that sort of thing, which was, I nearly died a thousand deaths.
That was difficult, was it?
Oh, dreadful. And that I was, yes, I was, my function there was to enable all of that. And, my classroom teaching didn't count at all. And so that from that point of view, it was just, that was just something that happened. I wouldn't have said that then. I wouldn't have been aware of it. I probably walked through the front gate feeling physically ill every day. Mm. Every day my husband would push me through the gates to just get through the day and cope with all sorts of things that probably I can't even remember now. Mm. And knowing that I was not one of them, because I was, and I think because we were women, secretaries were women. I mean, if you're a woman, you're a secretary. So that we were never on an even keel, probably. And even to go in the staff room, I'd sit in the corner if I sat at all. I mean, Georgie at least would sit on a seat. I'd never dream of sitting on a seat. All that sort of thing. Everyone had their own seats and their own place and all of this hierarchy that was this undercurrent. It was an undercurrent that you had to somehow learn everything, but no one would say anything because you were supposed to know. So, yes, from that point of view, I don't think I would have survived without Georgie and Jaika. Probably not.
Mm. Now, as head, did this attitude stem from him, or was it an inherited thing that was part of Shaw?
I think it was part of Shaw. I couldn't say that. There was a lot of older staff, and now I'm older staff. Now I realise how quickly it all passes. Mm-hmm. But I think the older staff dictated the tone of common room. Mm. That's how it was. And yes, I don't think the younger staff were... The younger staff had to keep their place. We were all numbered, of course, as you would be aware. So...
Numbered?
Of course. From the headmaster was one and the deputy was two, and then the hierarchy from when you were appointed. So when you were appointed, you were on the bottom. So I don't know what number I was, whatever it was. And if you got, when you were given an extra lesson to take or something like that, you were never, your name was never put on anything, or your initials were never put on anything, only your number. So you were not even personalised, if you like. And name-wise, if they did get your name, you were always addressed as your initials. So I was MNO. And Georgie would have been whatever she was. And so any correspondence, it's still not your name. So we're talking about wartime type thinking. It's a bit like the English who have an abbreviation for everything. And there's a very funny comedy where the comedian talks about all these short codes for all sorts of things. And it was a little bit like that at Shaw. Short
now,
codes for things.
Interestingly, none of the male teachers have ever talked about that numbering system.
Oh. Isn't that amazing? Yes, and gosh. Mm. So, there we are. So, I don't know what number I was when I left, but I know I'd got pretty close to the top 10.
And as people left, did the you go up the number scale?
That's right.
Very interesting.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And now, Jaika appointed, first of all, Georgie, then you, and in the interval, when you left what at the end of 1975, after your first 3 years there, there were other women teachers appointed. So obviously he wasn't adverse to having women on the teaching staff.
I just don't know, but obviously not. So if they were the ones that could do the job and had the qualifications, yes.
Yes.
Yes, so I think it's wonderful, because I guess for him it must have been, he'd know that he'd be taking on different problems, if you like, and that they might leave. And he offered me maternity leave, which was, I was quite amazed at that. I didn't take maternity leave, I went back after I'd had the children, but I had never thought I would go back.
Was there an unspoken dress code?
Yes.
What was that?
Well, I know that Georgie would have spoken about this, that men always wore coats and ties at all times, when they were in the classroom or outside walking. Georgie and I always had to wear some sort of suit and, you know, high heels and so on, which was not discussed for us. Men were never allowed to take their coats off, unless they were just in common room or something. You would never do it in the classroom. And one year, Georgie, it was so freezing, Georgie and I said, look, we really need to be in slack suits. And because the corridors were just so dreadful and the heating was nil. And so we actually went and asked him if he would, may we wear slack suits to school. And he agreed. So we were very fortunate in that. But yes, so there was a very, it was an well, I don't know if it was spoken for the men. They would never have dreamt of doing anything else, I think.
Mm.
But later on, after Jack had left and as time went on, yes, that actually, that became quite an issue with some of the men as well.
Mm. Because high summer in Sydney at the beginning of first term is tropical some years.
Yeah, of course, this applies to the boys as well, you realise, with the uniforms. And even today, at the end of the term, that's the last day they wear that uniform, and the beginning of second term, they're in winter uniform. But what's the temperature? So I haven't been quite so versatile on that one.
No. So from 1975, you took this voluntary break to raise a family.
Yes, that's right.
And what made you go back? It was a 7-year break.
Yes, that's right.
A 7-year break from Shaw or a 7-year break from teaching altogether?
It was from teaching altogether. I did have some students, just piano students at home, but that was not in a classroom or anything. And I actually had never thought of going back to Shaw. It had never occurred to me at all. And it hadn't occurred to me to go back anywhere, actually. I got a phone call from Robert Fox, and he said, there's a vacancy, someone's leaving, and I want to make two jobs. I would like to have split the job in half so that we have someone to teach in the high school. And of course, elective music was well and truly established at that time. And I was going to tell you that the year I left, that I went to England in the Christmas holidays, and I got a phone call from JICA saying that two of the boys had come first and second in the state in music.
Exciting.
And which was, I didn't even know you could come first or second in the state, I don't think. And I was absolutely thrilled to pieces, of course, and quite blown away. I had one student in particular who was outstanding. And I haven't mentioned him before. He was one of the boys, or two of the boys came from Balgala. Mm. And this boy, Warren Shuttles, came in year 10 with 8th grade violin and licentiate piano. Mm. And so he was an extraordinary student. And he had perfect pitch and so on, of course. And so in retrospect, I'm not at all surprised that he topped the stage. He taught me lots. I don't think I taught him much. But that was quite wonderful. But so elective music was established, and that was really good that Shaw was able to do that and to offer that. And so Robert said, I've got half a job in the high school or half a job in the prep school. And I said, well, look, I've got three children under whatever it is, three or under seven. And I said, you know, I really can't teach elective music and have a family as well, because it is an enormous job. And I said, what's in the prep school? And he said, nothing. And I said, oh, that'll be fine. Having no idea what that meant. Absolutely no idea what that meant. And I'd actually had a phone call a couple of weeks prior to that from a friend who did go and study at Addington Palace in the RSCM, called Michael Deasy. And he had been appointed to a cathedral in Canada, and he then came back to St Andrew's Cathedral. And we'd gone through the con together, he was a year ahead of me, and he rang up and he said, can you just come over and teach music? And I said, well, no, Michael, you know, I've got three children. And he said, yes, but I really need somebody. And I said, oh, I don't think so, Michael. And he said, look, think about it. And I said, oh, all right, I'll think about it. And so that was, it was extraordinary. I had these two phone calls within a couple of weeks. Mm. And so anyway, I didn't need to say, I didn't go over to St Andrews, which would have been nice because I'd known him and I'd studied at the cathedral with Michael Hemans on my way through when I did my fellowship in organ. And it was interesting that that all happened at the same sort of time. And I thought, I can't deal with the Harbour Bridge. And so I didn't. And I thought, well, I guess it'll be all right. It'll just be half time. And of course, the other minor thing was that I really didn't know very much about primary school music, only my prac teaching. Yeah. Mm. So along I went and started there. And David Anderson was the headmaster then.
He was appointed then, was he?
Yes. Peterson. Bob Peterson was first. Sorry, Bob Peterson was first, and then David later. A year. That's right.
This was 1983, and it was just the year before Jaco Travers retired.
Yes, and that, I guess, was another thing that I knew that. And I said to Martin, well, you know, I guess it's an opportunity to go back. And at least I knew what I was going back to, but I just thought, well, and maybe it's an opportunity, and I've got my organ, and if I go back to a state school, I will probably won't be able to carry on my organ with a family, because it would mean I'd have to take on a church as well. Mm. And that's a big thing to do when you have a city church. So all things seem to point to Shaw, and it was when David Anderson was appointed later that my job went to full-time. So I actually started a half-time, and that's why I took it, actually.
And yes. What was the state of music in the prep? Was it non-existent such?
Non-existent. I can remember Malcolm Howard at that stage. He used to do all the music. He did all the art. He did all the cultural things. He was just extraordinary. And when I was in the high school, Malcolm used to come over and play in my band on whatever morning it was, Tuesday morning or something. And he'd come over and my classroom, the two music classrooms were where the development office is now. So the John Colebrook room, that was the music room, and the development office. And they were my two classrooms that I taught in when I was in the senior school.
And this was in the first period.
That's right.
Mm. 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 So what had happened in the prep? Had anything happened at all?
Well, Malcolm taught them recorder. And yes, he did any music that was to be done and any art that was to be done.
Mm.
And so what was so interesting was, of course, they had appointed a teacher, but they had nowhere to put up.
Ah.
So I actually was under the trees when it was not raining. And then I used to go, the only place they could put me was in the boarders' muck-up room, which was in Hodges House. And it's where they put their bikes, their swimmers, their basketballs, their everything, and where they could just go whenever they had spare time. That's where I was.
With a piano?
No.
No piano, no nothing?
No. No. And we used to go to chapel, or however many times it was. And so, yes, it was pretty tough, and that was hard times. And even harder for Bob Peterson, because he didn't even have an office. We were in, the staff room was very, very small, and Bob's, desk was same size as anyone else's. I didn't have a desk or anything, but the others did, and his paperwork just went up. I don't know how he ever managed. So we all were, scrambling, is the word. And so I was sometimes allowed to go into the hall. And I ended up by being extremely frustrated because I really couldn't do, I just carried on. I just, did what I could with what I had, and we managed. In some sort of way, did something. And in the end, I said to Bob, look, we really want to make a decision. And so we decided that I'd just go into the hall. And so I then...
hall?
This was the prep hall.
The prep hall?
Yes, just the prep hall that was used for all sorts of things. Everyone who needed to do anything did in the prep hall. And so that, likewise, I still was, ousted all the time. But I actually had some cupboards built along the front of the hall, and then at least I was able to buy some instruments, and I was given a little bit of money to buy some instruments, and then managed to get a piano and all those things. So, yes, that's where I was.
This very much ties in with Hilary Valance's experience, because she'd come to the prep school about 1978,
right,
in the interval while you were having your break.
Yes, right.
And she said she existed in a cupboard.
Yes, that's a good description. I understand that. Yes. Mm. Well, I think the prep was pretty austere.
It sounded as though everybody existed in
I can remember Malcolm saying that he had a thermometer in his classroom, and whatever the degree was, that the boys were wrapped in everything they could, including their raincoats, because it was just perishing. And, this was bringing up boys properly, stiff upper lip and character building and all of these things. So, yes, I think it was a backwater for a very long time.
And you mentioned being able to buy instruments eventually when you got your cupboards. What sort of instruments did you decide to buy?
I bought tuned percussion instruments, Karloff instruments, and percussion instruments mainly, just so that we could have something that we could make music with, which was really nice. Not so we just didn't have to sing or whatever. So.
Was there a choir?
I think I must have had a choir, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I think I must have had a choir. Mm-hmm. We would have done the carol service, which had been established by Jamie. Mm-hmm. So, yes. And I, yes, there would have been a choir.
And
What about the quality of the boys, their talents?
Oh, were the there? Boys always have talents. the quality of the boys are always, they're just all wonderful. But I must say, I think in many cases, boys have always got talent, but it's opportunity, isn't it?
Mm.
And so if they have the talent and there's no opportunity, nobody, it's not developed. And so I think that every year I had boys who were gifted or talented, or who I think just with music you enable them, and it allows them to grow and to find a potential. And that's what, you know, education's about. And from my point of view, that was my thing, so that I was always interested in the boys who were musicians and who I felt I could do something for. So whether they were an instrumentalist or a singer or whatever they wanted to. One boy said to me one day that he wanted to play the bagpipes, and I went, oh, good. now what shall we do about this child? And so we ended up by finding a group of pipers that were up in North Sydney somewhere, and he used to go up and do his bagpipes on the chanter with this group. But yes, so you know, things developed from nothing basically, and it was need always. A child would come in playing something and you'd have to get a teacher or whatever it was, their interest. And so the Shore Foundation, the Shore Association, provided me with instruments, and I was able to apply or whatever. It sounds so terrible, so long ago, it was so complicated, all of that sort of thing, as it all developed. But gradually I was able to build up a wind band, if you like, and a wind set of instruments, a string set of instruments, so that we had basically a band or an orchestra over what we're talking, nearly 30 years, I guess. And that was all due to the support of the headmaster, Bob Grant, of course. When he came, coming from Canberra Grammar, which is an extremely musical school, he basically opened the door for music, because he allowed private music lessons to take place in academic time. And that single fact is the key to the music department as it stands today. Because before that, no child ever came out of class, and all music lessons were before or after school, or lunchtime. So you can imagine trying to keep any peripatetic staff was really difficult. And most children learnt outside, of course. So to put on a concert, you wouldn't have a band or an orchestra. You would have whatever child played whatever instrument, you put them all together and you did it. Didn't matter what it was. So I think my first concert was probably something like 20 guitars, 10 drums, one flute, and that sort of thing, as Georgia reminded me only recently. And I wrote for it. I wrote the music so that they could play it.
You?
Well, I had to arrange it so that you're putting on whatever you're putting on. And you did it. So when you had a penis like Warren Shattles, I did an abridged version of Rhapsody in Blue. And I was going to tell you about another boy that I had at Epping who ended up on staff with me. And that boy was Frank Sharp. So Frank Sharp, who ended up by being mass master. Frank was a clarinetist at Epping. And his last year at Epping was my first year at Epping. And we did a piece called Silver Threads Among the Gold, and Frank played this brilliant part in this arrangement, and that's how, one of the reasons we won this band competition, because of him. And then he studied at Macquarie University and applied for a mass job. And when he came in, I said to Fred Ross, forget the mass, he's a clarinetist, get him. And of course, he's participated in the music department ever since, and still does. So, yes, it's been an amazing association. And Frank's actually godparent to one of our sons. So it's been a very lovely, very lovely association.
So there were allies on the staff at various stages.
Yes. Having something in common, I guess.
Did this make a difference to the acceptance you felt? Did you start to feel better about going through those gates every morning?
Yes and no.
Remind me.
Yes.